Good evening. Welcome to Attack the System, and I'm your host, Keith Preston, here on Countercurrents. As everyone knows by now, we recently had an election here in the United States that produced a fairly solid victory for the left, or at least what's considered the left in the United States. And I want to talk a little bit tonight about some of the results of this particular election, and there's a lot of really interesting data emerges from the voting patterns that we saw in this particular election, and I think this election in many ways tells us a lot about the actual direction that our society's headed in many different ways, not just when it comes to issues like race, but also a lot of other things. So I want to first begin by trying to go over a lot of the data that comes out of the voting patterns. The New York Times published an overview of the voting patterns that I thought was interesting because it really breaks down the voting patterns along a lot of different demographic lines, some of which are very interesting, and you know, some of which don't really bode well for the future of the right in a lot of ways. But you know, there's still a lot that can be learned from it. First of all, women voted for Obama by 55% majority. Although what's interesting is that the vote of white women actually went to Romney by 56%. But women as a group voted for Obama. Obama also won the under 45 vote. You know, it was a sharp generation gap in this election, that and where the dividing line is roughly around age 45. We see that 18 to 29 year olds and went overwhelmingly for Obama. 30 to 44 year olds to a lesser degree. I think something like 60% of 18 to 29 year olds went to Obama, 52% of 30 to 44 year olds, whereas in the 45 to 59 range, 52% of those went for Romney, and then 54% of 60 and over went for Romney. So there's a very solid generational divide that cuts off right there in the crux of middle age, around age 45. All right. As many people are aware, as far as race and ethnicity, 93% of the black vote went for Obama, 73% of the Asian vote, and 71% of the Hispanic vote, with 59% of the white vote going to Mitt Romney. So Romney actually won the majority of the white vote. As far as family structures or arrangements, 56% of married people actually voted for Mitt Romney. However, 62% of unmarried people voted for Obama. 62% of working mothers of children under 18 voted for Obama. Parents of children under 18 went 51% for Obama. And of course, as we might expect, the homosexual vote was 76% in favor of President Obama. As far as education levels, we see that everyone holding less than a college degree voted for Obama by a majority. That is, high school dropouts, high school graduates, and people with some college all voted by a majority for President Obama, whereas college graduates tended to vote for Mitt Romney by 51%. At the same time, postgraduates, those with postgraduate degrees, voted a 55% majority for Obama. And as far as financial situation, again, we see a sharp divide right at the edge of the middle class. People earning less than $50,000 a year voted for Obama, and people earning more than $50,000 a year on average voted for Mitt Romney. The $50,000 mark is roughly where data collectors and people who study these kinds of things draw the line between the lower middle class and the working class and the middle class. So once you pass the 50,000 a year mark, you're considered middle class. Middle class to upper class people voted for Mitt Romney on average, and the poor and working class did not. As far as political affiliation, of course, Democrats, self-identified Democrats, liberals, and moderates voted for President Obama, whereas self-identified independents, conservatives, and Republicans went for Mitt Romney. Not much surprise there. Locality, people in large cities and people in secondary cities with a population of, say, 50,000 to 500 tended to vote for President Obama. People in rural areas tended to vote for Mitt Romney by 61% to 39% ratio. What's interesting is that the one of the closest results was among suburban residents. There was a 50-50 split just about between among suburban residents for Obama or Romney. So that's very interesting there. On religion, the Jewish and Catholic vote went for President Obama. Protestants, particularly those who are very religious, that is those who attend church at least once a week, or those who consider themselves to be born again or evangelical Christians, those went overwhelmingly for Mitt Romney, which is not much surprise there either. So what the overall data in this election, I think, shows is that the only significant constituency for the Republican Party at present, as shown by this data, is that that of educated, white, older, that is middle-aged to elderly, affluent Protestants who live in suburban or rural areas. Demographic, that is the white, affluent Protestants, are really the heart of the Republican Party today. 88% of the Republican Party's vote in this particular election came from that demographic. It's also precisely that demographic that is shrinking the most rapidly in our own society. And, of course, many commentators have pointed out that the Republican Party is appears to be on its last legs because of that. And there were some other interesting things that came out of this election that also are very indicative of demographic trends. For example, the first openly gay person was elected to the Senate. A first Asian American woman was elected to the Senate. The first Hindu congresswoman, and I think she says when she's sworn in, she's going to swear on the Bhagavad Gita rather than the Bible. Gay marriage was actually enacted by popular vote in two states. And that's rather interesting when we consider that about 8 years ago, in the 2004 election, gay marriage was voted down by popular vote in state after state after state. In fact, there are some people who argue that the reason George Bush was able to win re-election in 2004 is because people were coming out to stuff the ballot box against gay marriage, and that helped George Bush in that particular state. Now, I think there's some doubt about that. I think when we actually look at the numbers, it's not so clear that that's the case. But it is interesting, though, that only 8 years ago, in state after state, gay marriage was voted down. This time it passed by popular vote, not by legislative vote, not by judicial fiat, but by popular vote in two states. Marijuana was also legalized in two states, and not just medical marijuana, but just the general use of marijuana for recreational purposes. There was another interesting referendum that took place in Los Angeles, and that was something that was going to require actors and actresses in pornographic films to use condoms. That actually passed in Los Angeles. And I actually think there's some cultural significance to some of these things. The votes on gay marriage, legalization of weed, requiring condoms for pornographic performers. And I'll get back to that in a minute. But in many ways, this was a very historic election in terms of the what it really indicates for the way in which American society is moving. I've heard some people say that in 2008, when Barack Obama was elected, that that particular election was George McGovern revenge, and I think that's a pretty good way to really understand what's going on politically in our society today, because I really think that the Obama election and re-election represents the full coming to power or the consolidation of the cultural revolution that actually transpired in American society back in the late 1960s and 1970s. And what we're seeing now is that something that was a fringe movement, something that was a radical movement, something that was a type of revolutionary movement in the 1960s and 70s has now grown and to the point where it is the dominant political paradigm. And, you know, it's taken a 40-year, 45-year process for that to happen, but I think that's the process that has unfolded over these past 4 or 5 decades. We have to keep in mind that when people think about the 1960s today, you know, they see all the news footage and, you know, they've seen all the documentaries on the History Channel and that kind of stuff. And, you know, I talk to younger people all the time that, you know, if they even know anything about the 60s, they think that, well, you know, yeah, everybody was out there smoking pot and dancing in circles and wearing gaudy costumes and protesting the Vietnam War. But that was in no way reflective of the majority American culture as it was in the late 1960s and early 1970s. We do have to keep in mind that the average American, for instance, would see television news reports of, you know, what was going on with the counterculture and view that with abject horror. Back then President Nixon, you know, came up with this concept of the silent majority. And that is, well, you know, the majority of Americans that, you know, in his view were, you know, perhaps, not as loud about it, but were very disapproving of some of the cultural radicalism that emerged during that time period. And I think he was basically correct at the time. You know, while the radical left-wing political movements, the radical cultural movements that came out of the 60s and 70s were good at getting a lot of attention, you know, they were extreme, they were provocative, you know, they used a lot of in-your-face tactics in order to get their point across, it's still the case that they were not particularly popular with most Americans. I remember hearing it said once that the only thing that the typical American from that time period hated more than the Vietnam War was the anti-Vietnam War movement. And I think there's probably some truth to that. But the question then that's interesting from a purely, from the point of view of a political scientist or sociologist is, how did a movement that went from being a fringe movement eventually become the dominant political paradigm? And I think that what the radical left was able to do was essentially do what Antonio Gramsci had suggested way back in the 1920s, and that is that they needed to take a long march through the cultural institutions to the point where they really were able to influence society in their own direction, to go from being a fringe movement that most people had no use for to being a movement that is the dominant cultural paradigm. And how did they do that? I think that's really the big question. How did the radical left go from being a fringe cultural movement in the late 1960s, early 1970s to being what it is today, something that's really become a dominant political paradigm? So I want to explore some of that in the program tonight. In the early 1970s, the radical left changed its tactics a bit. The radical left moved away from confrontational street protests, street fighting, you know, riots, things like that, of the type that had, things that had happened in the 1960s. And it started working its way into institutions. One way in which the left did this is through assuming control of education, particularly the universities and particularly the humanities departments in universities. For example, if you go and you look at textbooks that were published over periods of time, you know, say from like the 1950s up through the present time, you see that over time and particularly in the 1970s, 1980s, there's a dramatic growth in ideas and different disciplines like history and political science and, you know, languages and all kinds of other things being presented in a way that reflects radical left-wing values or ideology. Another way, of course, is through moving into the political system. What the left did in the early 70s was it went into the Democratic Party and essentially took over the apparatus of the party itself. And that's a big change over what happened previously. Remember, in 1968, the radical left went to the Democratic Party convention in Chicago in 1968 and got into a fight with the police over their efforts to disrupt the Democratic Party convention. 4 years later, the left was right there at the Democratic Party convention in Miami. It was held in Miami in 1972, and they were in the process of taking over the Democratic Party's apparatus. And because of that, they were able to nominate George McGovern as the presidential candidate for the Democratic Party in 1972. And McGovern, of course, was a very strong anti-war candidate. On economic policy, he was very leftward leaning as well. For example, he advocated a guaranteed income for all Americans and things that are somewhat alien to mainstream political, American political culture. And as a result, George McGovern, when he ran in the general election in 1972 against President Nixon, he actually lost by a huge landslide. He lost 49 out of 50 states in the 1972 election. The only state that he won was the state of Massachusetts, which at the time was considered the most liberal state in the United States. McGovern even lost his home state, which I believe was South Dakota. And the reason for that is because to most Americans, McGovern represented the radical left. He represented the radical left subculture, you know, the hippies, the yuppies, the Black Panthers, the anti-war movement, the feminist movement, the gay movement. Most Americans look so askance at that President Nixon won by a huge landslide. And I see I'm running out of time for this segment, so I'll return in just a moment and discuss a little bit more about how the radical left has managed to come to dominate American society over time. You know, once Jimmy Carter was elected, he turned out to be a disappointment to a lot of people with a more socially conservative bent who had initially supported him. Nowadays, he has this liberal image of, you know, going around and doing his work with Habitat for Humanity, humanitarian work, working for world peace, monitoring elections in third world countries. But that's not really the kind of image that Carter promoted for himself when he was running for president. And he was actually running as a conservative Democrat, a Southern conservative evangelical Christian. When he became president of the United States, he became a disappointment to a lot of people. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that he turned out to be a lot more liberal than and people had perceived him as being. There were a lot of problems in the United States at the time, economic problems, foreign policy problems, that his administration was not able to handle. And so this religious right movement that had grown up in the 70s as a backlash, if you will, against the counterculture of the 60s and early 70s, latched on to Ronald Reagan and the Republicans in 1980. But what you see happening with the left is that while the left was able to seize control of the Democratic Party apparatus in 1972, they never elected a liberal Democrat to the presidency until Barack Obama. There was Carter, who ran as a conservative Democrat, a Southern evangelical. Then there was Bill Clinton in 1992, who ran as sort of a centrist Democrat. Once again, he was a Southerner, former governor of Arkansas, just like Carter had been governor of Georgia. He also claimed to be an evangelical Christian. I think a lot of evangelical Christians were suspicious of those claims. But essentially what Bill Clinton did in 1992 was he repeated Carter's strategy from 1976 to a large degree. He presented himself as a moderate to conservative Democrat from a Southern state, not as a liberal Democrat. And it's also true that Clinton himself was not associated with the most liberal wing of the Democratic Party at the time. He actually came from the Democratic Leadership Conference, which was sort of a centrist position within the Democratic Party. And then, of course, Bill Clinton was elected to two terms. George W. Bush came after that. But it was really when Barack Obama was elected in 2008 and now reelected this year that we really see this McGovern coalition that took over the Democratic Party's apparatus in the early 70s finally coming to power. It's almost a case where I think to some degree it's a generational thing. You have to consider that so many left-wing activists from the late 60s, early 70s were relatively young people, college age, maybe not much older than that, maybe young professional people. And now those people are all, in old age. I mean, somebody who was 20 in 1968, say, is going to be in their mid-60s now. So now that the 60s generation is essentially the elderly generation, or their generation has really come to power. And what they've done is they've managed to take over the cultural institutions in the process. They've managed to take over the universities, the teachers' unions, by extension, the public schools, and they've managed to take over much of the media, and the government apparatus itself. And when we look at the results of this particular election that was held, just a couple of weeks ago, that's what we see. We really see all of the different kinds of groups that made up the McGovern coalition in 1972 finally growing to the point where they are able to achieve a political majority. There was a Democratic Party strategist by the name of Fred Dutton who published a book back in 1971, and I can't remember the name of the book, but what Dutton argued, he had a lot of foresight as far as, his role as a Democratic Party strategist went, because what he argued is that the Democratic Party's traditional base of blue-collar workers, unions, the New Deal coalition had sort of expired its historical circumstances and wasn't really a viable political coalition anymore for the Democratic Party. And he said that in the future, the Democratic Party would have to reorient itself towards this new culture that had emerged. And he was saying, that the Democrats should be less of a blue-collar working-class party and more of oriented towards college students, professional women, educated, metropolitan professional people, racial minorities, all of the new kinds of identity movements with a left-wing slant that came out of that time period, gay rights, the environmental movement. Dutton argued that that was the future of the Democratic Party. Of course, it was the following year that those elements started to take over the Democratic Party, and they kept getting trounced in elections for a long time. They lost by a landslide in 72. They lost by a fairly significant margin in 1980. They lost by another wipeout in 1984. That particular year, Ronald Reagan won re-election with 49 out of 50 states. The only state that he lost was Minnesota, which was the state that the challenger, Walter Mondale, originated from. But what's happened is that while the Democratic Party was able to take over the the radical left was able to take over the Democratic Party, and in the process alienating most Americans of the time, and more or less putting the Democratic Party on the margins at least as far as national or at least as far as presidential politics were concerned for several decades. In that process, while the left was able to take over cultural institutions, the left was able to grow its own political majority. Now, the question is, how did the left do that? How did the left go from being a fringe movement to being a political majority? One way is obvious, and that's through immigration. If we have to consider that in the early 1960s, 90% of American society was ethnically or racially European or Anglo-Saxon, to be more specific. Since then, we've seen a major change in the racial demographics, to where white Americans generally are only about 2/3 of the population. So that's a very significant shift. And a lot of that, of course, I think can be traced to the immigration laws that were enacted in 1965. That essentially opened the borders to third world immigration. So demographic change resulting from immigration is a big part of it. Also, though, as I hinted at earlier, there's generational change. We have to consider that as everyone knows, the radical left of the 60s and 70s was largely a youth-driven movement. That's not to say that people of other ages weren't involved, or that there weren't seeds planted before that in previous generations. Young people were a driving force. And as I said earlier, those people are now elderly people. And we do really see a generational change that's going on, I think. I think it's interesting that in this recent election, Romney still won the votes of most middle-aged to elderly people. And I think that's because those are the people that are still left over in many ways from the old culture, people who didn't grow up in the public school systems, watching the mass media, going to the universities, as they were or as they became once the left cemented itself in the cultural institutions. So there's generational change. There's demographic change. There's the corresponding cultural change. That's what Antonio Gramsci said, that the left wanted to carry out its revolution. They had to dominate the culture. A lot of the thinking that comes out of the Frankfurt School makes a similar argument from the radical left, that it's really the culture rather than the economy that determines the nature of the society. So if you want to have a revolution, you have to have a cultural revolution, with less emphasis on an economic revolution. All of those things involve the lines in which the radical left moved throughout the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And now the left has been able to effectively achieve a new political majority. And as far as what this majority consists of, I think one thing that was interesting, and I gave an interview to Russia Today about some of the demographic results that we see coming out of the election. One thing I mentioned in that interview is that as far as religious perspectives go, people who identify themselves as secular, that is, as non-religious or anti-religious, as atheist, agnostic, something along those lines, non-religious people were as likely to vote for Obama as any other demographic. So I think what we're, and those elements tend to be concentrated in the elite. So what we see is we have this new secular, educated elite. People with postgraduate degrees tended to vote for President Obama. But we see this new elite that is aligned with this left wing of the middle class. I think that as the traditional white middle class has receded, in part due to changes in the economy and the shrinkage of the middle class generally, in part due to the rise of a minority middle class sectors, in part through cultural and political changes and in part through immigration, there's a fairly expansive left wing of the middle class that's in opposition to the traditional WASP oriented middle class. And I think that's obviously another important part of this new left wing or left of center political majority. And then, of course, we have the growth of a larger class of poor people. And I think that's largely because of, in part, changes in the economy once again, and also immigration as well. Those two things together have created a fairly large underclass. And we see that the new political majority that the the center left has created for itself, you know, in many ways transcends class barriers because it includes the secular educated elites. It includes the left wing of the middle class. It includes some of the newly rich, you know, the rich that don't come from the traditional big money families. And it includes the immigrant populations or, you know, the recent descendants of immigrant populations. It includes this large class of poor people, many of whom are non-whites. And it also includes the counterculture itself and its various dimensions, the feminists, the homosexuals, and so on. Those demographics, those cultural sectors collectively are now large enough that their coalition can form a political majority. And that's really the situation that we're in now. Now, when I'm almost out of time for this particular segment, when I return, I want to talk a little bit about the kind of society that this new political majority is actually creating. So I'll be back in just a moment to discuss that. Welcome back to Attack the System. Tonight I've been talking a little bit about how a new political majority has emerged that is represented by President Obama's re-election. I've gone through a little bit of the statistical data and the demographics showing how this new majority breaks down, not only along racial lines, but class, religion, culture, a lot of other things. And I want to talk a little bit about the actual kind of society that's being steered by this new political majority. One thing that's interesting is that as President Obama since President Obama's election in 2008, the anti-war movement has completely dried up. There's really not much public opposition at all to military interventionism. In fact, most of the consistent or most principled or most outspoken opposition to U.S. military interventionism is coming often from the right, from the radical right, you know, the paleoconservatives, the alternative right, some of the libertarians, and so forth. The left-wing anti-war movement has largely disappeared. Also, just as this, you know, left-wing cultural majority and demographic majority is taking power, the economy is going backwards. We see ever widening class divisions. We see the growth of a huge underclass. We see very high unemployment rates. The unemployment rate was never less than 7.6% during the entire time of Barack Obama's first term. Right? In past decades, it would have been impossible for a president to win re-election with an unemployment rate of 7.6% or higher, but that's what happened this time. So we see that the economy is going backwards, becoming much more of a conspicuously plutocratic economy. We also see that there's been a significant erosion of civil liberties under President Obama, who's ostensibly a liberal. We have to remember it's President Obama who signed the National Defense Authorization Act, which, among other things, allows the state to detain American citizens indefinitely without trial, which is a serious breach of the traditional legal principle of habeas corpus. That's something that, you know, we find in Anglo-Saxon law going all the way back to the Magna Carta. We have to remember it was the Obama administration that claimed the right to assassinate even American citizens merely on suspicion of criminal acts, terrorism and things like that. So the police state, the war on terrorism, all of those things were actually expanded, often dramatically so, under the Obama administration beyond what they had been even among George W. Bush. So we see an ongoing restriction of civil liberties. We see ongoing economic decline, widening of class divisions. We see barriers to American military intervention disappearing as this supposedly progressive, supposedly liberal political majority is taken over. So what we're seeing emerge now is a society that is essentially a plutocratic, imperialist police state with a liberal left-wing face, you know, one where the political class and the managerial class, or the bureaucratic class, are increasingly integrated along the lines of race and gender and homosexuality and religion and all these other categories. But where the state is becoming very plutocratic, where the economic system is becoming very plutocratic, the state is increasingly repressive, the foreign policy of the nation is increasingly aggressive. And that's, you know, in spite of all the supposed, you know, cultural liberation that these people have brought us. Now, one thing that I also think is interesting, and there's some interesting stuff we can do with this. And that has to do with some of these referendums that were passed, legalizing things like gay marriage, in a couple of states by popular vote, legalizing marijuana, requiring pornographic film actors to use condoms in Los Angeles. I think that what the cultural significance of those referendums is, what the political significance of them is that we have a society that's increasingly repressive, increasingly exploitive, increasingly violent, increasingly aggressive militarily, but it also is a society that allows for all these different forms of controlled decadence in a way that's almost like a safety valve. You know, it's sort of like an outlet that distracts, people from, you know, concentrating on more serious matters. But in a limited controlled way. You know, for example, one thing I find very interesting, I'm fairly libertarian on social issues, as everyone knows. And when it comes to, for example, the question of gay marriage, you know, I'm less offended by that as much as I just think it's silly. You know, I think that gays need marriage about as much as the 50% of married people that end up getting divorced. And I think, you know, as Justin Raimondo's pointed out, what's really going to be interesting is not gay marriage, but gay divorce court. But, you know, nowadays, you know, we're saying, yeah, homosexuality is fine. Yeah, you know, but gays can go out and get married and be respectable bourgeois couples and, you know, presumably have a same-sex version of the house with the white picket fence and their adopted kids or whatever. You know, nowadays we say, yeah, you can smoke marijuana and you can do so in the safety of a Starbucks type coffee shop or something like that, which I presume is the goal with some of this kind of stuff. Even pornographic films, you know, that's fine, you know, but you have to be healthy about it. You know, you have to use condoms, which is a silly regulation because it's not enforceable. And what that's, I think, is doing, where I see all those policies going is they're allowing for this type of controlled decadence where, you know, you can have all this, you know, you can indulge in all these things that are traditionally considered decadent, but, you know, you have to do so in a way that, you know, reflects the therapeutic values of the nanny state. You know, they want to take the danger out of it, I think. What that reminds me of is actually an old episode of the Star Trek TV series. The original series with William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy. There was actually an episode of that called, I think it's called Return of the Archons. But in this episode, Captain Kirk and his associates go to this planet, and this planet is controlled by this weird cult. They have this leader called Landru, who's really just a holographic computer image, and he's the image of some leader that lived thousands of years before. And the people are under a system of mind control where they're really just brainwashed, you know, zombies. You know, they're like the Moonies or something like that. And then they have these characters and these enforcers and hooded black robes like the Inquisition, where they go around and summarily execute people who disobey. So it's obviously a very tightly controlled, totalitarian, cult-like society. But on this planet, they also have this thing that they call the Red Hour, and they call it a festival. And every so often, the people are not only allowed, they're actually required to participate in this festival that basically just amounts to, you know, an orgy of looting and burning and, deviant sexual behavior and so forth. It's really interesting if you ever have seen this particular episode, but that's what I was thinking when I was looking at these election results. I was thinking, well, yeah, it's like they're legalizing all this decadence, but in sort of a controlled way, at the same time that the general political atmosphere becoming ever more repressive, you know, more economically exploitive, more violent, and so on. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting political and sociological studies we could do with that, I think. As for the question of the future of American politics, I think that obviously as many commentators, you know, far more mainstream than myself, have observed, the Republican Party's in deep trouble, and now we have these Republican establishment figures out there saying, well, you know, problem is we've got to be more diverse, we've got to be more inclusive, you know, we've got to have more Hispanic voters or more women voters or whatever, which I think that strategy is completely unworkable. You know, there's no reason whatsoever for the different political interest groups, the different demographics that make up the Democratic Party coalition to go to the Republican side at this point. Of course, there are other people who are saying that the Republicans should move further to the right, and, you know, perhaps have a hardline conservative candidate, which I think the problem with that is while there might be more conservatives or more conservative leaning people would come out to stuff the ballot boxes for someone like that, the other side of it is they would lose whatever moderate support they have. They would lose a lot of swing voters or independents they had. They would lose a lot of minority voters that they had. So I think that's fairly self-defeating as well. And some people are wondering whether the Republican Party will actually disappear from the American political scene. And while I wouldn't go so far as to say that that's what's going to happen, I do think that the Republican Party is going to be very ineffective in terms of its ability to compete in national elections for quite some time to come. You know, it's those people who are saying that there may never again be another Republican president, you know, may be right, you know, or maybe not, maybe something that could happen that could swing the pendulum back in the other direction, you know, a severe economic crisis or, well, you know, terrorist attack or whatever. But it's clear that the future, the political future for the time being, really does belong to the radical left, which is now really the center left. You know, it's what was the radical left in the 1960s, 1970s has now become the center left, and it's really become the dominant mainstream political paradigm, as I said earlier. And this is a trend that we see going on not only in the United States, but in the Western world generally. Most elections that have been held this year throughout the Western countries have seen a leftward shift, you know, in Germany, in England, in France, in Greece. And I think a lot of that is in turn traceable to the economic. You know, most nations now are struggling economically, or at least experiencing economic downturn. And that has the effect turning the vote towards the left, because people start being more receptive to more populist or, you know, socialist or progressive leaning measures. They want the government to intervene in the economy to do something for them. And that tends to push the vote to the left. So the future of American politics, at least for the foreseeable future, I think really does belong to the left. The question, in my view, is, what will happen when that paradigm is no longer viable? When the current left wing, left of center, left liberal paradigm, you know, recently voted back into power a couple of weeks ago, is no longer viable. When that coalition starts to crack up and all the different component parts, the different demographic groups, the different political interest groups that are its component parts start turning on each other, what's going to be the new paradigm that comes along to replace it? And I don't think that that's something that will happen for quite a while. Probably not until perhaps the middle part of the 21st century. Because while I think that, I think that the way that our society is going to continue to push things leftward. I think the demographic change, the generational change, the cultural change, the economic downturn, the lessons of past partisan cycles, you know, political parties in our society in the United States tend to, you know, hold power at the national level for 35 or 40 years. Then another party comes in for the same amount of time. So what all of those trends show is that, the present day liberal paradigm should be dominant for another, probably another few decades, probably till middle 20th century. I think that the ever-expanding class divisions, I think the demographic transformation that's going on is going to, on one hand, ensure the dominance of the left for some time to come. But I think in the long run, that will be the undoing of the left, because I think there will be a split among all these different kinds of constituent groups for the left along all the predictable fault lines, race, class, culture, and other things like that. And I think that the ongoing economic downturn, which isn't going to get any better. I think the economic conditions are going to continue to get worse. And that's going to be to the benefit of the left for some time, because there will be more and more calls for state intervention, for, assisting the poor and workers and things like that. But at the same time, it also will breed political alienation, and people will start looking for other alternatives. There was a very interesting discussion here on Countercurrents recently. It was a roundtable by Matt Parrott and Greg Johnson and Professor Kevin McDonald on the question of secession movements and the viability of secession movements. And I actually did another interview recently on Russia Today where I was being asked about these secession petitions that have come out of the election results. You know, now that a lot of people are obviously unhappy with the election results, those who are on the losing side have started filing petitions for different states. What they're doing is they're not actually filing any petitions that have any kind of legal significance. But what's happening is on the White House website, you can just about anyone can set up a petition, and anybody that wants to can sign it as many times as they want to, I think. And people are calling for their own states to secede. And I know when I was being asked about this on Russia Today, the interviewer seemed to have the mistaken impression that this represents a large, important movement, and it's really not. It's really just people screwing around on the internet. But it does represent that something that can develop into an actual movement. There can, and I think will be, secession movements that start to grow and are serious movements at some point in the future. And I think that they'll probably they'll originate from a lot of different directions. I think that what's driving a lot of these secession petitions is probably disgruntled Republicans and conservatives who don't like the fact that their side lost the election. But I think we'll start seeing a lot of other kinds of fractiousness in American society in the future. I think that as society becomes more diverse through immigration, through cultural change, that it will be harder for the political class to maintain loyalty to itself. Like right now, the way that it works for the left is that the left is able to rally all of its constituent groups against one common enemy, and that common enemy is really just traditional WASP society, traditional white Christian European American society, which they, view as, guilty of things like racism and sexism and homophobia and all that. And I think that's really the defining characteristic of the left today. In my own conversations, with leftists and reading leftist commentary, what I see is a lot of people on the left losing interest. I know there was an article published by Chris Hedges, who's a writer from the radical left. There was an article published by Hedges called, I believe it was called, The Disappearance of the Liberal Class. And he was talking about how the left has totally acquiesced on many of its conventional issues, like supposedly being against imperialist war, upholding civil liberties, protecting the social welfare system and so forth, the environment even. The left has acquiesced in favor of all these forms of left-wing identity politics. And I know I heard a lot of that in this election. I know one of my associates at Attack the System was telling me about someone he knew who was, I think, was gay, and who said that, I'm going to vote for the Democrats because they uphold gay rights, and who cares about foreign policy and civil liberties and all these other issues. And I think that's the way that the left is really staking its claim to political power, by being the anti-WASP party, the anti-white Anglo-Saxon Protestant party, and by appealing to the identity interest of its own, of the component groups within its own coalition. And of course, that's the way politics works. Ultimately, people tend to side with their own tribe. That's how people do things. So the big question is, once this center-left, left-liberal, cultural Marxist paradigm is no longer viable, what's going to come after that? Is there going to be some new political majority that is going to be able to replace it at some point in the future, probably decades down the road? And another possibility, and I think one that's very interesting, and it's related to this concept of secession that was being discussed on Countercurrents earlier that I've written extensively about in other forums, and that is the possibility of building not one single national political coalition like the Democratic Party and the left have done, but building lots of regional coalitions whose component members may vary in many ways from locality to locality or region to region, but collectively all of these regional and local political majorities form a collective national majority. And with things like secession, decentralization, more autonomy for regions and communities and things like that being a means of handling some of these kinds of disputes, I really think something like that is the real wave of the future as far as American politics. You know, when I was talking to Russia Today recently, they were asking me about that. They were saying, well, do you really see secessionism as something that can solve some of the problems we see in the United States with the economy, with cultural conflict, and so many other things, foreign policy? And I said, well, something has to be tried unless you think the system can survive in its present form indefinitely. And I don't really see much of a case for that the United States can go on in its present form with all of its current problems indefinitely. So something will replace the current system. And they asked me if I, why secession was a viable option in terms of dealing with some of these problems. And one of the main things is that because there's no consensus on what the solutions to the problems are or which problems are most pressing. We see these embryonic movements like the Tea Parties, the Ron Paul people, the Occupy Wall Street, all these other things. And we see how much disagreement there is, not only between these movements, but even within these movements as to what the problems really are, what the solutions might be. And I think that the future of the system is that there's not going to be any unitary system. There's going to be lots of different systems for lots of different kinds of people, with lots of different kinds of values. You know, those are the things that I like to talk about and write. Those are things that I write about and that we, issues we deal with at attackthesystem.com. If you're not familiar with attackthesystem.com, please, visit our website, read some of our material. Always feel free to make a donation to try to help us out in some of our work. You know, the more support we have, the more we can do. And that's what we'll talk about in some future programs, here at Attack the System on the Countercurrents Network. Thank you for listening. Have a good evening.